Hi, I'm Matthew McCabe. Welcome to Miracle Voices. Each episode, my co-host Judy Scutch-Whitson and I will be delving into stories of forgiveness, healing, and transformation that have come about from integrating the principles of the book A Course in Miracles. If you want to learn more about A Course in Miracles, visit www.acim.org. If you'd like to visit Miracle Voices site, please go to www.miraclevoices.org. Now here's your program. Hello, Miracle Voices listeners. Just a quick note before we get started. Today's guest shares about his journey that includes some psychedelic drug use. Just a reminder that the guest's opinions are not reflective of the Foundation for Inner Peace viewpoint on drug use, and that this interview is provided for informational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. Please talk to a licensed physician before making any decisions that may impact your health. And with that, here's your program. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Miracle Voices. I'm with my co-host, Judy Scutch-Whitson, and special guest today, Bill Melton. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Well, this is kind of a fun treat today. We've got a guest. We've done a lot of podcasts with this, me and Judy, and now we have a guest coming onto the scene to share his insight and experience with the course. Bill, if you would, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and then how you found the course? Or how I found you, I should say.
Quick review. I grew up in the American Midwest with a fundamentalist family, completely rebelled against that. Went to Asia, studied Asian philosophies for 4 or 5 years in the late 60s and early 70s. Came back, found my first computer, fell in love, did a hard right turn into computer life. Lived as an entrepreneur and an investor in that world for most of my life. At this point, I'm retired and pushing 80. About 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, I had my first interaction with a course. It was one of those books that people said you should read. I picked it up, read it, didn't like it at all, tossed it on the side and said, oh, but not for me. Fast forward until about 5 or 6 years ago, along with my wife, we were in Brazil at a John of God retreat or experience. And during that time, I had a totally unusual experience for myself. I'm not given to visions. I'm not given to any kind of alternate sort of experiences. But in that particular case, I had sort of a 3D holographic image presented really in high fidelity, full color, an image of a black brain with a red sort of neon vein-like lights rippling through it. I, thinking that maybe I was had eaten something I shouldn't have, checked with my wife and another person standing with me as to, did they see any of this image? No, they didn't. And after probably 3 to 4 or 5 minutes, the image passed and nothing at all beyond that was unusual, except from that experience, I had an immediate, almost driven desire to reread the course. I don't know where it came from, how it happened, but that was there. So I came back and immediately, while I had found the course very off-putting the first time I had read it, I looked at it, this time I couldn't, you know, it was a daily thing. I couldn't get enough of it. And so for the last probably 6 years or so, it's been part of my daily life. The text part of it particularly is it's where I go. And I use Audible earphones and listen to the very wonderful Audible version that's available. And frankly, I go to sleep with it. I have it in my ears at night. And it's the primary lens through which I see the world these days.
Well, I got to ask, what do you think the black brain with the red dots are? Is that related to how you would later? Is it like foreshadowing? Is that what that was?
I don't have a clue. And I guess one of the parts I was listening to last evening of the course was talking about we don't understand, and to attempt to think we can understand is a, you know, is a bit foolish. These things are just beyond beyond understanding, though we try to. But no, I don't have any clue. And to try to assign some logical sequential reasoning to it would be that would be silly. No, I would like to, but I can't.
I think I would say here, Bill, that a lot of people have had strange experiences that either led to the course. Someone told me about, he was in a bookstore and it was on a high shelf. He didn't see it, wasn't looking for it, but it fell on his head. So, but I had an experience that is sort of, it's in that ilk. Again, you don't analyze it. It just was. I was just starting to study the course with my teachers, Helen Schuckman and Bill Thetford, scribes of the course. And we were meeting every day to study and for them to help teach me. So I would sort of catch up a little because they were way beyond me. And I dreamt or had a vision. It wasn't a vision. It was auditory. But I'm not sure I was really asleep or I was just in an altered state suddenly when I heard what I call decaphonic sound. It was as if 10 tape recorders, in those days we didn't have computers, but it was as if 10 tape recorders were going off in my mind in separately, all reading different parts of the course at once. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like cacophony to me at all. It felt like some kind of a speed up. And I told Helen and Bill about the experience the next day. And Helen said, "Oh, honey, it's really trying to push you along in every way that you know. Don't worry about anything. Just lie back and let it happen." but you know, these things, we can't really explain what our interior guide, our higher self, the Holy Spirit, has for us to catch our attention. It's almost like any symbols will do.
And we're so, in our normal 3D world, we're so caught up in linear sequential thinking. And certainly my experience with the course and the experience with psychedelics would tell me that linear sequential thinking is such a tiny little brother to what is really going on. All of these real things, and real in the sense that the course uses the word, are not limited by time and space. And whether they're decaphonic or megaphonic, it's all going on so far beyond our poor sequential minds trying to get it, that it's sometimes frustrating, but other times, as you say, you just, okay, lay back and enjoy it and go with it.
Bill, I'm curious, how has the course or integrating course principles in your life, has it changed your relationship or changed your perceptions of what your life is like and what its purpose is?
Absolutely. As I said, the course is the lens through which I look at the world now completely. During my time as an entrepreneur and my time as a business guy, I was pretty much a hard-headed materialist. I'm at the opposite end of that spectrum at the moment. I would have to say that the psychedelics and the course came to me more or less at the same time. That is about 6-7 years ago. And both of those quickly take you beyond the world of being a hard-headed materialist. If anybody lives in the course and if anybody is sensible about the psychedelic world, you do not come out of that at being as a hard-headed materialist. You get to the other end of the spectrum pretty quickly.
Okay. And have you had any kind of, how would you say the course has worked in your relationships, interpersonal relationships, any changes there or any changes people have described since you started working with it?
I guess the person that you would expect to be most aware of transitions in your life would be, somebody that you're married to or is your principal partner in life. And just based upon feedback that I get from my wife, she testifies or comments almost on a daily basis that I'm not at all the person that she got together with now nearly 20 years ago. There's no question that as an entrepreneur, I was pretty hard pushing. I was probably very judgmental, given to snap decisions, and not at all immune from using coercive or manipulative behavior. I thought that was just part of the job of being an entrepreneur, part of being a leader. I try not to do that at this stage in my life. I try to, be on the opposite end of that spectrum. Now, we're all human, and I certainly am more than human, and I do silly, stupid things rather frequently. But being coercive, being manipulative, being judgmental, just those simple human traits or values, the course really leads you on a new path. And it certainly makes living together much easier.
Yes.
The whole concepts of being judgmental, and most of us are so bloody judgmental, and being able to let go of that just improves human relationships by leaps and bounds. Certainly being coercive is or being manipulative is just not good for human relationships. Forget about any spiritual values, just simple being a good, happy human. And so all of these things are not only taught, but reinforced and repeated through the course. And to the degree that you try to align yourself with any of those values, your human life gets better. It's just part of, it works.
Bill, you mentioned that you came to the course, or it came into your life in a prominent way around the same time that psychedelics did. And I wonder if you can explain anything about that. Certainly, we know that many people from the early days, I'd say the late 60s, have been experimenting with the kind of altered state that helps you delve deeper into beingness with something like a psychedelic. And I know that you have the experience and the wisdom and the probably commitment to go as deep as you can. How do those two work together for you?
Let me go back into my own life history. As a kid, as I mentioned, I was raised in this fundamentalist Midwestern religious family. And at that point, then, as I went to Asia and studied other philosophies and other religions, I had a graduate degree in Asian studies. I was convinced at that point that the origin of these mystical experiences or conversion experiences or whatever these kinds of experiences were that I saw running through all these different religions or different philosophies, I was convinced that that was probably a particular spot in the human brain that malfunctioned. And if we could just find that particular spot and we could cure it, and then we could be done with all of this foolishness of religion and philosophy. So actually, at that point, I did begin a degree in neurophysiology, a PhD in neurophysiology after my Asian studies. And had gotten probably 2.5 or 3 years into that degree before I found my computers and did the hard right turn into computers and high tech. But through that, I had been aware of and interested in many of the teachers and books in the whole field of psychology and neurology. And one of the people that I followed most of my life has certainly been Stan Grof. And through a series of accidents, appearing here in California, as I say, 6 or 8 years ago, I managed, we were reconnected with Stan Grof and the other elders in that whole community. Ralph Metzner, people like that had been in this community for a long time. And so with that kind of thoughtful, deep minds that considered these subjects, both my wife and I became more than curious. We were students, and we tried to understand what they were doing. And the fact then that it was coincident or close to that, that I became acquainted and involved with the course, I have been struck continually, consistently, year after year, as to some of the deep, concurrent, parallel lessons that appear in both pathways. As the course says, truth is truth. And wherever you find these same understandings, these same learnings popping up, and then when you find they're completely consistent, then you kind of start paying attention. There's a terrible old joke that it's sort of the reverse side of this. You know, when somebody tells you you're drunk, why don't pay any attention? And somebody else tells you you're drunk, you know, don't pay any attention. But when the third person tells you you're drunk, at least lay down and think about it for a while. Well, so the reverse side of that is when you read something or learn something and it seems, well, come on, guys, that can't be true. And so you don't pay too much attention. And the next time you hear something that's almost identical, then you don't know, okay, maybe, but don't pay too much attention. And then you hear it the third time from some different source, you say, okay, time to lay down and think about it for a while. And that's the sort of thing that happens between the course and some many psychedelic sessions. And when I read the course, there's things that the course says, and the first time you hear them, you said, come on, guys, you can't be serious. I mean, the whole course is cosmology, that we created our own world here. I mean, come on, guys, you can't be serious. But then, and it says, you know, things about time is under my control, the course is speaking, and it says they can arrange time and space. And again, you say, come on, guys, you can't be serious. But then in psychedelic states, indeed, you see that time completely changes from the linear world. And you see that time is very, very changeable. You can be all at once. Time stops, time starts. And certainly, the course talks all the time that, you know, we are not our bodies. And of course, the first time you hear that, you say, oh, come on, you know, I bump my knee, that's my knee, it hurts. Yeah, I am my body. But the course repetitively over and over and over tries to get us to understand that's not the case. Well, when you take psychedelics, you very, very, very quickly learn you are not your body. You're your mind. And what is your mind? You ask all those questions. Well, the course says it thinks. Yeah, it does think. So you have, and I think this is probably my most powerful experience with the course and with psychedelics, is when I'm sitting and reading the text is words on the page, and I kind of get it. Most of the time, I think I'm getting it, even though much of it is, you know, a little bit of that you can't be serious sort of a thing. But then when I have my earpieces in and I'm listening to the chorus, and I'm in an altered state with the help of the psychedelics, those words are no longer words on a page, but they jump off the page and become full bloom understandings. And again, the poor teacher of the course had to use our poor sequential language to try to get us to understand these things. And our poor sequential language is not really set up to be anything other than linear and sequential. So how do you teach something that is not linear, not sequential, in a linear sequential language? As beautiful as the course language happens to be, it is still cursed with being linear and sequential. But then when you match it and put yourself in these altered states where you're not in a linear sequential state of mind, and then you listen to those words, then the point is that you drop into you drop into states that are so powerful that are beyond words. Now, the course talks about revelation as being beyond words. And the course using words as best as linear words can probably be sequenced points to, hints at, tells the story around, but it's the experience, the visceral experience, the revelatory experience that cannot really be contained. And it's obviously it's not just a it's not just an intellectual exercise, and it's an emotional exercise. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, they have this saying that you can point at the moon, and people tend to look at the end of your fingertip as you point at the moon, and you have to remind them, my finger is just pointing in that direction. It's not the moon. And then simultaneously, in many of the Indian, more of the guru-oriented traditions, they feel it's very important when one starts to wander around in these fields. It's important to have, in the Indian sense, a guru or a teacher to somewhat hold the space for you. Certainly in our modern psychedelic or psychological training environments, we know that it's very important to have space holders. Because these are energies that are, I believe, and my experience tells me, that these are energies that are not sort of the very thin cup of tea that we normally drink in our 3D lives. And these experiences need to be held with care and with love, and preferably in the community of others that are used to experiencing and feeling these kinds of energies. And indeed, these kinds of energies that are exposed and not held in communities of care and wisdom and strength can go off the rails somewhat badly. We all know stories of gurus that had the shadow side of their personalities that were not well managed. Ken Wilber, one of the modern day philosophers, talks about waking up and growing up. In other words, spirituality tends to help us wake up to the truths of beyond this life. This life, but beyond this life. But also there's the whole process of growing up and being responsible and mature and holding space and all of that. And these two don't necessarily happen at the same time. In other words, we have a lot of people that are very responsible, that are very grown up, but they're not woke up at all. On the other hand, we do have, unfortunately, too many experiences of people that are woke up, so to speak, in Ken Wilber's language, but not grown up at all. And so there is a role for community space holders that as we touch into these spaces, whether there be spiritual spaces or whether they be psychedelic spaces, and these spiritual spaces and psychedelic spaces, each one of them are powerful. And then you match them together. It's a powerful collaboration or conjunction or coming together. So for people like Judy that have, and the other teachers of the course that have held the space now for these many decades, I find myself continuously in deep, deep gratitude. And for their counterparts that hold the space with care and with love in the psychedelic world, I'm also in deep gratitude. So
I'm thinking, Bill, as you're speaking, and I moved into that emotional experience too, which I very much appreciate that you shared in its transparency of how you get so deeply touched when you go beyond words. What happens is, it's ineffable. There are no words to describe it. As Bill Thetford used to say, it's hard to F the ineffable. But not being able to talk about it in our ordinary language is part of it. I think that's an important part to recognize. I have not, although I have many, certainly many, many friends who were experiencing the early days of experimentation and learning with psychedelics, and I always loved to know what was going on. For me, somehow or other, I would have these experiences spontaneously. Now, I don't know what was going on, the physical mechanism we call the brain, possibly something very similar. Why they happened to me spontaneously, I have not the slightest idea. I wouldn't even begin to try to assess any reasoning why. I just know they happened from about the time I was 9 years old. Did they happen every day? Absolutely not. They happen years apart sometimes. But those are the experiences that stay with me more than anything else. The study that I do in my daily life with the course is to sort of catch up to the experiences. And the experiences gave me, I guess I never thought of being, you know, the word placeholders, but they were my placeholders. I knew in a particular experience that the world disappeared in form as I know it. The individuation of my personality was gone as I know it. And I was just in, for lack of a better expression, a field of forever with no time, no boundaries, no language. But my little mind at 9 years old in ecstasy was saying, now I know, now I know, now I know, over and over again. Yeah. When it was over, I couldn't tell you what I knew. It wasn't a thing or an idea. It was a feeling of being at one with everything, interchangeably in a way so much blended and held as one that there was nothing but the one. And that one to me was the thought of, now I know. I've had certainly others since then that have sort of are my placeholders for different ways of thought. And I realized in a way that got me ready to receive the course. Now, when I study, read, pray with the course, I know sort of what the outline is of non-duality. And I can transverse the feeling of non-duality at will now for a longer period of time. Something kind of interesting happened in the last few weeks. I'm going through an aging process. I'm almost 90. All sorts of things come with it. You never know what to expect of the bodies that we made. But with me, it's taken a form of pain. And so my doctor considered that it was pain. There's no reason for me to bear this much pain. I'll put her on prednisone for a week and see what happens. And the drug prednisone is a very powerful drug. And I had never been on it. And I just knew that he did not want me to suffer, and I didn't either. And so I was perfectly okay during the day, meaning I felt I was functioning, and I could sit at my desk and do my email. I could talk to people on the telephone. When I lay down at night to go to sleep, I do as you do. I listen with my pods to the course. Right now I'm going through Song of Prayer over and over again, because it appeals to me right now. But under this particular experience, medication called prednisone, oh my God, it was like I was bumped up for the week that I took it. I was bumped up in my hearing of the words in Song of Prayer into more of an experience of gratitude, where I was lying in bed weeping with joy. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling in some way that sort of connects with similar experiences that you may have had. But each experience, of course, is directly guided by that which knows, our internal teacher, our higher self, the Holy Spirit, into what we individually can understand and learn and accept, although the idea is common to us all.
Yeah, that experience of knowing this is real, this is more real than real. When you're in the depth of these kinds of experiences and you recognize that in the course, when something comes to you through the course, somehow you say, yes, this is real. You know, I started all of this by answering Matthew's questions by saying we shouldn't try to figure all of this out, but, you know, we're humans. And so I do try to figure this out all the time. And in fact, I sent Matthew, you a little video. It's a study. It's a report, a YouTube study of that has been recently released in 2019, I believe. These were studies around DMT. DMT, as you probably know, has been referred to. In fact, there was a couple of books put out. DMT is called the God molecule. Now, this particular YouTube and other research that I have done is consistent with this, is that if you look at most spiritual traditions, whether it's the yogic practices of India or other practices with psychedelics, all of them tend to stimulate the production of DMT. And I have long been suspicious, in a positive word, of the use of that word, that people who have spontaneous spiritual experiences have been somehow blessed by an excessive internal supply of DMT. DMT is, to use a technical term, endogenously produced. That is, it's produced by our own bodies by multiple different places in the brain. Certainly the pineal gland is one of the places, but it's not the only place in the brain that produces it. And these DMT then goes throughout the body, carried in the spinal fluids and other fluids through our body. And it seems as though that when people are having these special experiences, there is a co-occurrence of that DMT. Now, why would it be called the God molecule? And how is this in any way relating to the Course? Now, this is pure, absolute speculation on my part. Yes, with an informed speculation, but still speculation. You know, we have much of how our body works and our brain works. It has all of these signaling molecules. On the pleasure side, we have the serotonins and the dopamines. And on the pain side, we have an equivalent set of hormones that are pain signaling. And indeed, people that are in psychological stress frequently have an excess of the pain signaling hormones. But one of the interesting things that happens in whether you're talking about deep long-term meditators, or you're talking about people who are truly at peace, or if you're talking about people who are using some form of the the DMT molecule, in all cases, what seems to happen is that what we call the default mode network. The default mode network is the part of the brain that organizes all of the subcomponents of the brain. And that part of the brain goes into a quiescent mode, a more quiescent mode, when we're in any of these kinds of experiences. So if you look at the deep breathing things that the ancient Hindu religions or the Vedic religions did, or you look at the meditative practices, or you look at some of the extreme breathing practices, holotropic breathwork, for example, all of these have a signature of increasing the DMT in the brain and quieting the default mode network. Now, why is that interesting? The default mode network seems to be very closely associated with our sense of self. That is not the big self, but our small self. Who am I? Am I as tall as you are? Am I prettier than you are? That's all associated with my self-definition. And what does the Course talk about? The Course talks about our egoic self, meaning that equivalent small self that we become overly identified with, that we turn into some sort of an idol, that it is the point of separation from all that is, from the divine. And indeed, that same thing happens when this default mode network, our brain-centered sense of self, is quieted and dissolved. So indeed, again, to use the words of the Course, we remove the blocks to knowing. We remove the blocks from knowing love. Now, I have no way of knowing whether my speculation will be borne out, and I think it's probably dramatically more complex than all of that. But again, that's one of these situations where you see the same pointer toward truth from three or four or five different angles. At least you want to stop a little while and think about it.
Yeah. Bill, you mentioned DMT, and that particular drug, dimethyltryptamine, as you mentioned, comes from the pineal gland and other parts of the brain, but was really kind of had its breakthrough moment with the Netflix special called DMT. I think it was called The Spirit Molecule. The spirit molecule, maybe it was like that. Anyway,
yeah,
it was
because sometimes called the spirit, and sometimes it's the God molecule.
Yeah, and that documentary was about a study of a researcher who gave DMT to a bunch of subjects. And it's just fascinating. If you haven't had a chance to see it, I encourage everybody to take a listen or to watch it. But in this specific instance, we're talking about 5-MeO DMT, which is a little bit different. Can you just talk about what DMT is and then specifically what 5-MeO DMT is?
Yes. All of the different psychedelics, I would say most of the traditional psychedelics, whether you're talking about ayahuasca or whether you're talking about mushrooms or psilocybin, or whether you're talking about just straight DMT or 5-MeO DMT, all of them have DMT as the primary or one of the primary core agents that precipitate the results. Many of us are involved in training psychotherapists to use some of these medicines in their clinical work. And some of these medicines and that sort of training is totally above board, totally legal, part of state-approved universities. And certainly the works that MAPS or that the organization MAPS is doing is all part of this above board, totally FDA approved studies. So all of these different medicines have some of this same core chemistry inside of them, but they have different modes of action. Some of them take a long time. Ayahuasca tends to be an overnight or 8 or 10 hour exercise. Psilocybin, mushrooms tend to be 6 to 8 hours. And all of those are great, perhaps for weekend retreats, but if you're a therapist trying to work through a 50-hour minute, that's not so convenient. So Ralph Metzner, many years ago, who was one of the Harvard Three, with Ram Dass and Timothy Leary and Ralph Metzner were the three guys way back from Harvard in the 60s and 70s. Ralph Metzner really believed that in order to make these kinds of medicines available to a larger group of people in a safe, secure clinical setting, we had to have a medicine that would act in a very short period of time, and then you'd be able to, you know, after sitting in the waiting room for 10 or 15 minutes, be able to go out and get in your car and drive home. And so it turns out that 5-MeO DMT is that medicine. The 5-MeO DMT originally came from it's known as the toad medicine, or comes from a certain brand of toads in the South American and Mexico deserts. I really discourage using that because it's not nice to the toads. And secondly, you never know whether the toad was having a good day or a bad day. You don't want to take his medicine on the day that he had a fight with his wife. That's not a good medicine. Right. So it's the manufactured or chemically made 5-MeO DMT that I really recommend be used for clinical practices. So this is a very short acting. The trip itself is only 15 to 20 minutes long. Historically, 5-MeO was used with these vaporizing pens that had a bowl on the bottom of them, and that bowl then had the medicine vaporized, and you would inhale it, and that would take you on quite a dramatic journey to the center of the cosmos. One of my friends says it was sort of like a spiritual bungee jump. spiritual bungee jumps might be okay for some people sometimes, but that's not good in my mind for a daily use. And so the methods that we use these days are through a very tightly titrated, very closely controlled potency pens. These are vaping pens that you can start with any potency that's appropriate for your experience and your level. And then you take yourself only to the level that's appropriate for what you're doing today. for example, and then you can use these pens to take the 15-minute meditation to a half hour or to an hour or to an hour and a half, depending on whatever is your set-aside schedule for the day. And so typically, I will sit down again with the course in my ears, and whatever passage that I'm working on or I feel that particularly I need to have more understanding of, I will use a very light dose such that, to use the analogy of sort of your a foot in each world, I'll have my left foot, so to speak, very much in my logical, analytical thinking here today mind, and my right foot will be in the world of the non-dual. And again, most of these philosophies have a strong affiliation or a strong association with these non-dual understandings beyond time, beyond space, beyond logic, beyond these things. So if you can have a foot in each world, and then as you have the dance of that day's meditation, you can say, well, no, I want to hang on a little bit more to the logical side today. Or no, I've listened to that. I think I've got it. I think I totally have absorbed it into my logical brain. Now I want to go explore these thoughts in the non-dual state. And so you just inhale a bit more, a bit deeper, and then you can step over into the completely non-dual state. And you can step back and forth, much as a dancer would ease back and forth, and to experience it both with the logical mind and then in the non-dual state. So 5-MeO is a very loving medicine. It's sort of a heart-opening medicine. Your heart opens. It's gentle. You can step out of one of these meditations and step across the room, get a glass of water, and sit down at your desk and be right back where you are, feeling energized and active and sharp as you would be otherwise. So as opposed to some of the more traditional ayahuasca mushrooms and so on that really take over your day or take over your weekend, this 5-MeO in the form that I'm using it is loving, it's gentle, it fits into my day. I can have a hour meditation after I've gotten through my normal work. Hour meditation is over. I could go up and join the family for supper. It's very appropriate and efficient for our kind of modern life.
That's really interesting. Okay. And so you say you can kind of calibrate how far you want to go. You're kind of control in terms of velocity and depth by the not only the ratio of 5-MeO DMT, but also the concentration. So there, when you say the concentration, there's like an emulsifier that dilutes the 5-MeO down to a level that you think's reasonable, something that makes it viscous. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. These are the same kinds of pens that they use in the cannabis world. And many of they use them, unfortunately, in the world of nicotine too. But they're pens that you mix in the material of interest, in this case, the 5-MeO, with an emulsifier. And the pen is really made up of three parts. It has a battery. The battery is the one that drives the little heating element in the emulsifier. And then you have the little emulsifier that has that is heated. And when it's heated, it turns into a vapor. And then it comes up through the mouthpiece that you inhale into your lungs. And because the barrier from getting whatever's in your lungs into your brain is rather rapid, you have more or less an immediate onset. And so with a little bit of experience, yes, you can control either. And again, you have varieties of pens in your pocket. You know, it's like having an artist, if he's going to be doing some sketching, he'll have a red pen and a blue pen and a black pen. Well, in your pocket, when you're doing these kinds of things, if you're experienced, you'll probably have a pen that is lighter, and you have a pen that's a little bit heavier, and I have a pen that's heavier yet. And so if I have been listening, standing on my left logical foot for 10 or 15 minutes or 20 minutes for a particular set of passages in the book. Now I may want to take it just halfway so I can experience it a bit more deeply. At that point, I might bring out my blue pen and hang out there for 15 or 20 minutes. And now when I think I'm really comfortable and I really have a deep understanding, all right, now let me go clear over into the non-dual side. So I'll pull out my red pen and I'll take a couple of inhalations from that and go completely over into the non-dual world and just hang out there. And again, depending on the day and what the schedule is and what I've learned, that's all changeable on a day-by-day basis.
Wow, that sounds cool. Great. So that last pen you mentioned is probably like a 1-to-2 ratio. Is that what it is?
Yes, that's a one. In this particular case, it's a 1-to-2 ratio, meaning it's one part of medicine for two parts of the emulsifier.
Okay. Very interesting. And so so California and Oregon are kind of trendsetters and trailblazers right now, because even as we speak, it seems like psychedelics of various kinds are getting at least decriminalized. Can you talk a little bit about that, where we're at as far as you know?
Yes, of course. All of this was totally open for complete medical research in the 50s and the 60s. And in fact, I find it highly ironic that the LSD, when it was first developed and was used by people like Stan Grof and so on for their early research in the 50s and the 60s, the drug manufacturer at that point thought that this drug might be useful for studying schizophrenic states, sort of multiple parts to ourselves. And quickly they found out it wasn't good for schizophrenic states because it somewhat allowed you to have methods of solving schizophrenic problems. And of these schizophrenic states, most of them are, I would consider, almost spiritual problems. We have separation among our different parts and separation from the divine. And so now today, all these decades later, these methods are being used to bring ourselves back into awareness of our non-segregated states, that is, our unitary states. So, anyway, that all proceeded up until I believe it was the late 1971, perhaps, when Nixon found that people that have had these kinds of spiritual experiences were not very good soldiers anymore. They really weren't interested in going out and killing each other anymore. They weren't really interested in believing myths about I'm going to kill you because you're terrible and so on. And so, of course, those that understood the impact of this realized they had to shut this stuff down because you were going to turn the country into a bunch of citizens that weren't really interested in being soldiers and killing folks. So that was shut off, as we all know, and everything, all of these drugs were classified as of having no medical use and of being no use to mankind whatsoever, and being classified in the most toxic levels as you can classify drugs. Well, indeed, during the last 3 to 4 years, at a rate much, much faster than what any of us expected, there has now been a total new renaissance of experimentation, of study. There's not a major university, I think, today that is not looking at these kinds of things in one form or another. Michael Pollan's book that has now become a modern meme, Changing Your Mind, is a revisitation and restudy of these things. It's brought these discussions into the mainstream. And there is now huge amounts of money flowing into research in these areas. Many of us are concerned that these monies flowing into this kind of research will tilt the field over toward the world of big pharma. And most of us are very concerned that that's not the way to go. We really want these things to be used in a non-extractive way for human healing and for human flourishing. And to the extent that they can be, to be used for aiding and abetting in the study of deep spiritual insights. So that's, I guess we will get to, again, humans always get to revisit whether or not they're going to misuse these wonderful tools that have been made available to us or not. And hopefully many of us hope that we will use these tools properly. But yes, the many states, the state of Oregon now has decriminalized all of these kinds of medicines. The city of Oakland, Santa Cruz, Washington, D.C., Denver, and Colorado, there's various forms of either legalization, but more in the form of decriminalization. And the difference between those two is to say something is legal is to sort of stamp the state's approval on it, where on the other hand, if you say we're going to decriminalize it, it just means, no, we're not stamping a state approval on it, but we're not going to throw you in jail for using them either. And a decriminalization seems to be the more middle path from a legal standpoint to get these things approved quickly. Just last week, there's a bill presented to the California state legislature following closely along the Oregon pathway that the objective is to decriminalize these in the entire state of California. So I think it's probably getting to the point now where many states will be moving toward decriminalization and opening this up to be used openly in public. And once I say publicly, I'm not necessarily encouraging just a lot of recreational use. I'm encouraging the use in safe and secure settings. You don't give your five-year-old kid the keys to your car and say, go out and have fun. You make sure that the safe and setting is that, you know, that they've had some training. And I think that's certainly these are powerful tools, and they're tools to be used with care and with love and with intelligence.
Very interesting, Bill. Judy, do you have any questions or comments at all?
Actually, I'm sitting here as a learner, and I wanted to thank Bill so much for sharing that, his experience and his knowledge with us. I know that many Course in Miracles students who might be listening to this will probably have questions, but coming back to answers to the questions, we don't have the answers. What Bill Melton has generously shared with us today is yet another way of experiencing truth. And to open our minds and hearts to whatever it is that the Holy Spirit within us will give us as a tool to learn, to remember, to remove the barriers and the blocks, as Bill suggested, to the awareness of love's presence within, is a step forward. I think it's kind of marvelous to be living during a time, as long as we still see ourselves in time, where we can see progress made in people wanting to remember the experience of their true identity, which is love. And for that, I thank you tremendously, Bill, for sharing your wisdom and our knowledge base with us today, and also your tenderness and your emotionality about how the state of knowingness, oneness, allness, non-duality, love affects us so deeply that it changes our lives for the better.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Bill. That was, I'm great. Yeah. I'm really grateful to get a chance to hear your message about this and how you connect more deeply and integrate course principles here. This is something that I think we're just the bow wave of, and it's going to be helpful for people, you know, in the next few years in a way I don't think we thought would be possible. And it's very touching to me. You know, I was thinking, you know, while you were taking a moment there, just I've had these moments similar to you where there's just like spontaneous crying almost, where there's like a deep remembrance that comes to the fore. and everything else just kind of goes away for a moment. And it's just like this recognition. Oh, like, okay. And that I recognize that when you were taking a moment there. So I appreciate that. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your miracle voice here on Miracle Voices. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening today. Please subscribe to Miracle Voices by hitting the subscribe button on your podcast app. If you are enjoying these conversations, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you use. And lastly, please visit us at miraclevoices.org and join our newsletter so we can stay connected. Until the next podcast, I want to leave you with my favorite course quote, "When you want only love, you will see nothing else."